slow the coronavirus, Europe is walling itself off. So is Africa.
We're imposing a travel ban on foreign nationals from high-risk countries such as Italy, Iran, South Korea.
Meantime, in Italy...
For many of us, going out for a walk is a way to feel less lonely and to combat our fears. There are 5 people in front of a supermarket, waiting for their turn to go in. They are standing 1 meter apart to avoid contact.
Italians reflect on their new normal. And too much screen time while you're at home? Mr. Motivator is here to help.
Imagine that there's an orange between your shoulder blades or a lemon, and I want you to gently squeeze the juice out of that lemon or orange.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today on The World. So many questions about the coronavirus. At a personal level, when will life get back to normal? At a community level, can our collective actions stop the global spread of the virus? Michael Minnick can help answer some of these. He's an infectious disease specialist at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. He also oversees lab testing for viruses at Brigham and Women's Hospital here in Boston. I asked Dr. Minnick about news out this week from the CDC that the coronavirus can last for days on surfaces we touch.
We actually know that coronaviruses can last on surfaces, potentially for hours and maybe even days, which is what that study showed. But I think it's important to recognize that even though they can technically last for days on a surface, whether or not they really remain sufficiently viable to really cause an infection if they've been sitting there for a few days is still under question. And I think we have to take some of those types of pieces of data with a bit of caution.
Yeah, but I mean, should we worry about getting coronavirus from touching a surface that was contaminated yesterday?
I think that we should all be aware, and I think having that in our minds is certainly important, and that's essentially why the public health community is really pushing the message of wash your hands, wash your hands, wash your hands because of these particular issues.
So wash, 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 social distancing as well, bywords of this pandemic. Remind us once again, Michael, why it's so important for many of us to remain at home and keep our distance from other people.
Yeah, so social distancing is absolutely the way that we will control and reduce the transmission of this virus in the population. Every time you go out and you're around a group of people, it takes just one person to potentially spread it to quite a few other people in that group. And this is how small outbreaks can start, and each one of those can go on to seed other outbreaks. And this is particularly relevant right now because testing still is not at where we need it to be in the population.
Right. Let's get to testing. At this point, how available are tests in the U.S. and how does that compare to other parts of the world?
So unfortunately, tests remain quite limited in the United States. We are seeing the expected increases in testing. We will see more and more testing come on board in the next weeks. But unfortunately, that means we're still in this place where who can be tested and how frequently they can be tested is still extremely, extremely limited. And in terms of where the United States is relative to the world, we are still doing poorly as a country. The numbers of tests that we're running per individual in this country is very small. I think that it does show that we have a lot of work to do over the coming years to really prepare for what's inevitably going to be another epidemic at some time in the future.
Well, on that point, I mean, there is a bar graph making the rounds showing the levels of testing in various countries. South Korea shown to be very aggressive in testing, Italy somewhere in the middle zone, and the U.S., frankly, right at the bottom. Based on what you know from Italy and South Korea, are you able to extrapolate out what the lack of testing in the U.S. will mean for the caseload 10 days from now here?
It's very difficult to extrapolate out how exactly the dynamics of testing are going to play out, because what we're seeing happen in this country, even in the absence of testing, is pretty major changes in society. And this is governors and mayors and federal government getting on the TV and in the media and saying we need to quarantine and we need to self-isolate and social distance. I think the message has gotten across from the epidemiologists and the physicians that the coronavirus is here and present and all around us. And whether we have testing or not, we can all make an assumption that it's outside somewhere. And so let's social distance. And my hope is that these pretty drastic measures that we're starting to see across the United States are going to have an impact regardless of whether or not we have testing.
So what would it take to ramp up testing to kind of start approaching what Italy and South Korea have been doing?
So my estimation is that to get the U.S. to a point of testing that is similar, for example, to South Korea, would require the U.S. to be performing about 100,000 tests or more per day. To get to that number right now, it's going to be very difficult. That's because we actually need to be performing these tests in very specialized clinical certified laboratories. And the tests themselves that are available right now are generally not the right types of tests that normally fit into these laboratories in terms of the technical expertise in those labs. Last week, we saw that Roche Diagnostics came on board with sort of what we call a sample-to-answer test that they got FDA approval for. And that is what is going to really allow us to get up to speed with testing in the United States.
Michael Minna is an infectious disease specialist at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. Dr. Minna, thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Italians have to stay at home for at least 2 more weeks. That's a mandate from the Italian government. Italy now has more than 35,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19. Nearly 3,000 people have died. A few hours before Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte announced the recent lockdown, Francesca Berardi took a walk in the industrial city of Torino in northern Italy. She took her tape recorder and chatted with some people she met. At the time, none of them could have known that it was going to be their last stroll outside for a while.
It's a sunny day, 70 degrees outside. I'm about to go out into a neighborhood that I know by heart, but it now feels strange. The change we're going through is enormous, both individually and collectively, especially in our working lives. For many of us, going out for a walk is a way to feel less lonely and to combat our fears. There are 5 people in front of a supermarket, waiting for their turn to go in. They are standing 1 meter apart to avoid contact. I head towards Valentino Park along the Po River. There are lots of people in the park. Some of them are keeping an eye on their children, who are running around to let off steam. They've been home from school for more than 2 weeks now. Others jog or ride their bike. Most walk alone, talking on the phone. It's never easy to approach people on the street for an interview. But at a time where everyone is avoiding contact, it's even harder. I exchange a look with 2 women, walking together at a safe distance. I stop them and ask what the impact of this situation is on their job, if any. They are high school teachers, and they are struggling to teach their classes remotely. They are using phone calls, emails, and online platforms that in most cases haven't been properly tested.
Stiamo tentando, ma non siamo ovviamente preparati perché insomma finora abbiamo sempre fatto.
We are trying, but we are obviously not prepared because up until now we've always taught in the classroom, so it's a mess. We have to learn just about everything, and there are some who know more and some who know less.
Back in the streets of my neighborhood, known for being one of the most lively of the city, there are very few people around. Metal shutters cover the doorways of shops that have been forced to close. Shop owners have posted and written signs that say, "We are closed. We don't know for how long." It is precisely this uncertainty that makes the atmosphere so sad and distressing. I pass by a hotel called Tomato. It looks dark inside, but I see that the front door is ajar.
Ciao Tommy, puoi parlare?
No.
Ti aspetto un secondo.
It's Tommaso, the owner and a friend from high school. He opened this backpacker hotel 9 years ago, and his business was going so well that he expanded it recently. Tommaso speaks good English.
Yeah. This was before coronavirus.
When did you close?
We closed on the 28th of February, but already from the 22nd, 23rd, the place was basically empty. And we were getting a lot of cancellation, even for October, September, October, so.
Tommaso is doing what the government recommended, asking his employees to take their holidays.
I'm sure that this will radically change the hotel industry in Italy, because a lot of family hotels, they will probably close. This depends a lot of on what the government will do.
The tourism industry is greatly hurt by the new coronavirus. It is expecting a drop of more than 30 million tourists over the next 3 months. And those most impacted are small businesses. This is exactly what's happening to the owner of an historic neighborhood bar called Biberon. He's sitting in front of the bar's window. The metal shutter is kept cracked open so that he can hear music from inside.
Qui non si parla più di economia generale di un anno. Qui si parla che si sta lavorando di giorno in giorno.
Here we don't talk about general economy anymore. It's a day-by-day business. If you didn't get cash today, tomorrow you're having trouble getting supplies. And the cash you do bring in goes away with rents, salaries, taxes, fines, etc., etc. There's nothing left.
Even though the government claims no one will lose their job because of the new coronavirus, few people actually believe it.
Non c'è soluzione, secondo me.
There is no solution if it continues for a long period of time. For now, I ask my two employees to stay at home.
The Italian Parliament has approved investment of up to 25 billion euros for economic recovery, money that will increase Italy's debt. As we often say, quoting a popular movie, non ci resta che piangere. Nothing left to do but cry or joke.
Abbiamo l'alcol come antidoto.
We have alcohol as an antidote, but it isn't enough. I thought it was, but it's not.
I walk over the train station. It is almost empty. Near the train tracks, at two checkpoints, police officers review the documents of passengers who need to board. The government has issued new rules. Anyone caught traveling without a valid reason could be fined and even sent to prison. Prison? This idea, in the back of my head, makes places like this, a beautiful train station, look like a dystopian space. Outside the station, I meet a young woman. She's a doctor and works in Alessandria, one of the first Italian cities to be placed in lockdown. She's new at the hospital, but soon she could be asked to help out in the emergency room.
E adesso è un momento critico anche perché proprio cominciano a scarseggiare, a mancare.
Now is the critical moment because there's a shortage and a lack of protective equipment like masks.
Italian doctors are fighting a war, often in conditions that put their own life at risk. They're working around the clock and forced to make painful decisions, like treating one patient and leaving another one to die. And no one knows how long this will go on.
La vedo lunga come situazione, lunga perché.
It's going to be a long time before we can breathe a sigh of relief. It's going to be months before we can get back to our normal lives.
Just hours after I finished my stroll, the government announced new restrictions. Everybody must stay at home unless they have a valid reason to go outside, like pick up medicine or buy food and maybe cigarettes at the nearest store. People can go for a run to maintain physical and especially mental health. Some of my neighbors are following a new trend. Every day at 6 p.m., they come out on their balcony to sing with the entire street. Not everybody in Italy is happy about them, but these flash mobs promoted on social media remind me of a sign I saw hanging outside a bar. It read, "The bar is closed until the tempest is over. Enjoy the wind." For The World, I'm Francesca Berardi, in Torino, Italy.
You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman, you're with The World. These are strange times, to say the least, but life marches on. This is still an election year here in the U.S. The World's Rupa Shenoy brings us a story of a Muslim candidate in Virginia who's trying to get elected and heal divides.
By his own admission, Oz Dillon hated Muslims.
I was very prejudiced against Islam.
After 9/11, he says he watched the kind of news that trained him to see all Muslims as extremists.
I would see somebody with a hijab and mutter, you know, to myself or to them, you know, what a disgrace they are.
In early March, when Dylan saw a Muslim American man running to represent Virginia in Congress, it made him mad. He tweeted that the candidate, Qasem Rashid, was unfit for office. And Dylan included a hateful meme that falsely portrayed Islam as promoting violence.
It's abhorrent what I did.
What he did is common. Many Muslim American candidates for elected office get hateful messages. It can be scary. But Qasem Rashid, the candidate Dylan attacked, almost seems to welcome them.
I see them as opportunities, and that can sound a little bit callous, I know.
Rashid has reason to be callous. In Pakistan, where he was born, his Ahmadiyya Muslim community is persecuted. He's had family members die there. Rashid grew up in Washington, D.C. and Chicago and became an activist and human rights lawyer. Last year, a man was convicted of threatening to lynch him. Running for Congress has made Rashid more of a target. Still, he says he has a policy of engaging with people who send him hate.
For me, the bigger risk is for me to stay silent and not try to neutralize this hatred. Because if I do that, as my children get older, they'll have to suffer through it.
Rashid and his wife Aisha have three young children. Aisha says Rashid's always been fearless. She's the one who worries.
I'm not going to sugarcoat it. I do feel anxiety sometimes. One day I woke up really anxious because I had a nightmare about his public profile as a Muslim.
But she supports him. So when Qasem Rashid saw Oz Dylan's hateful tweet, Rashid's first instinct was to do what he's gotten accustomed to doing, responding with links to educational articles that dispel falsehoods.
But then I noticed something peculiar, that, you know, Oz and his wife are struggling with massive medical debt.
Dylan and his wife had set up a GoFundMe site for donations toward their $27,000 medical debt.
I thought, well, I don't actually have $27,000 to give this guy, but I do have the ability to throw about 50 bucks his way, which I did. And then I tweeted it out to my followers, and lo and behold, we raised initially about $1,000 for him.
It totally flabbergasted me. I was humbled beyond belief. It's almost humiliating. I felt very, very small. I felt really, really bad.
He texted me his home address, and he asked me to come visit him at his home. And I took a yard sign with me for my campaign because he asked me to bring one.
Rashid says he never expected anything in return, and he told Dylan so. But Dylan says he felt honor-bound to do something for Rashid. They planted Rashid's campaign sign in Dylan's yard together, and they talked.
He has been enlightening me a lot about the myths and misconceptions of Islam.
The two took a picture together, and Rashid tweeted it. It got a lot of attention. CBS and NBC did stories. Dylan says they've raised all the money his family needed. Rashid admits things don't always go this well. One time when he donated to a GoFundMe for someone who had sent him hateful messages, the man's reply was less than kind.
He was gleeful that I had helped him. He was clear that he still maintained his racist views. And maybe I'm naive. Maybe I'm just a hopeless fool.
But Dylan says what Rashid did changed him. He says he's learning to see everyone as an individual rather than making assumptions. Now Dylan is the one getting hateful messages.
And this is from friends, mostly from strangers, but even from some friends that think I'm a dupe, that I'm being used.
For now, he doesn't seem to mind the harassment. He's free of medical bills and open to new points of view. For The World, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
When crisis hits, marginalized communities, no matter where in the world they are, often get hit the hardest. With the spread of the coronavirus, humanitarian organizations are working overtime. Across the globe, they're helping people with limited resources. Abby Maxman leads Oxfam USA, which is focused on poverty relief. Maxman says aid organizations are confronting serious challenges right now with the outbreak.
This is forcing a concurrent set of events. Triage, because of course we need to make sure everybody is caring for their own families and our staff while continuing to deliver our humanitarian and development programs, while also working to scale up programs. We're doing everything at the same time, and these are extraordinary circumstances where everybody is affected.
And so what can you still do, and what has coronavirus forced you to stop doing?
We're scaling up our hand washing and water sanitation hygiene work, helping communities get access to the information they need about the virus and how to stay healthy. But we also know that in places like refugee camps, where social distancing is so difficult, some of the infrastructure needs are just not possible.
Abby, as you look at the map of the world right now, what populations are you most worried about as COVID-19 continues to spread?
We know marginalized communities, refugees, migrants are disproportionately affected. We know that women, as well as frontline health workers, are disproportionately affected. So we're deeply concerned about the impact on poorer countries that have weaker health systems, places where people are already facing multiple threats to their health and livelihood. This is going to require a global coordinated response as a matter of priority.
So Oxfam, like the rest of the global economy, relies on supply chains for your humanitarian work. I mean, we can't get hand sanitizer and toilet paper here in the United States. How are you doing it?
We're working with the international community, WHO and others, to make sure that the pre-positioned supplies are being distributed and communities get access. But we are actually seeing a risk to the basic supply chains. They're going to be overstretched. So we can foresee lack of access to basic supplies and also strains on health systems and people who are already carrying a heavy load.
Have border closings had an effect on your work?
We're having to pause and rethink how we are going to have access to a combination of supplies and the basic technical assistance and experience that we share across countries and regions. That is really just happening as we speak.
By definition, Oxfam is an organization built around responding internationally to crises, short and long term. What is your assessment of the global response? And what, in your view, should be the ideal way for governments or NGOs to help populations all over the globe right now?
Well, the COVID-19 crisis is truly exposing the broken and unprepared system in the United States, not just testing our systems, but our values as a nation. So we're redoubling our efforts to make sure that we don't just isolate and insulate, but we reach out and maintain the support that's needed to make sure that those communities are not cut off.
Abby Maxman, President and CEO of Oxfam USA, thank you for your time and good luck, Abby.
Thanks so much, Marco.
News headlines are a minute away. You're with the world. Desperate times call for detailed plans to keep the U.S. government functioning no matter what. And one surprise in that doomsday planning?
The president himself is actually not all that important to the functioning of the U.S. government.
I'm Marco Werman. How plans that were written for nuclear war are relevant today. That's coming up here on The World. The land entrances and exits to the U.S. are closing down. The U.S. and Canada have agreed to partially close their border to combat the spread of the coronavirus. Here's Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau earlier today.
We recognize that we took some significant steps over the past few days. We closed the borders to overseas travel on Monday. And today, 2 days later, we announce that we are restricting non-essential travel between Canada and the United States.
Trade and commerce will not be affected. Trudeau said today's announcement came after several days of talks. It's the first major change to the northern border since the September 11th attacks in 2001. Here's President Trump this afternoon.
It's the invisible enemy. That's always the toughest enemy, the invisible enemy. But we're going to defeat the invisible enemy. I think we're going to do it even faster than we thought.
The Trump administration has also looked into tightening the southern border. The coronavirus has yet to be recorded in large numbers in Mexico, fewer than 100 cases confirmed as of today. Mexico is taking some measures. Schools are closing nationwide, but movie theaters, restaurants, and gyms all still open, as are international flights still coming in and out. The restrained response has some in Mexico worried. Here's reporter Emily Green in Mexico City.
Life in Mexico continues pretty much like normal.
including a massive music festival called Vive Latino, which happened just a few days ago. Around 45,000 people attended. At the entrance, they had their temperatures tested with an infrared thermometer. Those who ran hot were turned back. I didn't go to the festival, but a friend did and asked some concertgoers questions for me. David Figueroa, a publicist, was comfortable being there, but he's washing his hands constantly.
Hay que aprovechar que aquí en América llegó tarde y entonces eventualmente llegará más fuerte. Pero hoy está en lo que cabe normal.
He says he was taking advantage of the fact that the coronavirus still hadn't hit Latin America hard. He was determined to enjoy possible last moments with a big crowd enjoying entertainment. Christian Morales is with the Pan American Health Organization in Mexico. He says Mexico is taking adequate measures to stop the spread of the virus.
I think we are on the right track here in Mexico. The authorities have been planning the different scenarios for right now more than a month.
Mexico is offering free coronavirus tests, but only about 1,000 people have gotten it. The test is only available for those with symptoms and who have recently visited a country with high infection rates or had direct contact with someone who tested positive. And that's raised concerns there are way more cases than being reported. Still, Morales insists, as of late Monday, Mexico didn't have cases of local transmission, which he refers to as phase two.
Right now, I want to reiterate that Mexico is in phase one with only imported cases and transitioning very quickly, probably, to phase two. But still, we are in phase one.
But Mexico stands in contrast to its Central American neighbors, which have virtually closed their borders despite only a handful of cases. Travelers from Europe report entering the country without being screened. The popular soccer league was still holding matches in front of packed crowds as of a few days ago, among the last in the world to do so. This is worrisome, says Carlos Del Rio. He is a global public health expert at Emory University in Atlanta.
The sooner you start doing something, the more likely you are to stop. And this is the key, is that you cannot wait until you have a problem before you start doing something, because then you're way behind the eight ball.
One of the reasons Mexican officials may be moving slowly is the economy, which was already teetering even before the coronavirus pandemic. That means public health concerns are being weighed against the economic consequences of canceling big events or shutting down the tourism industry, says Duncan Wood. He heads the Mexico Institute at the Woodrow Wilson International Center in D.C.
An astonishing number of people, I mean, you know, probably around 60% or even more, are in the informal economy. In other words, they depend 100% on the money that they bring in every day.
And Wood says Mexico's response has been hampered by its president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who earlier this month encouraged citizens to keep hugging, despite the advice of his top health officials. As recently as this weekend, he posted a video of himself hugging and kissing his fans.
The president is a man who resists the established wisdom. He says that he has his own data. So we have public health officials in Mexico scrambling to prepare themselves, but at the same time got a president who appears to be minimizing the risk.
Mexico recently announced more steps, including suspending the soccer league and canceling major government events. And people here, they're watching closely. Primavera Diaz works in communications and went to that big music festival, Vive Latino, held here a few days ago, even though she was worried about the coronavirus.
Si el gobierno y las autoridades no están diciendo como que se pospone o se cancela, pues tengo la confianza que pues por algo lo están diciendo, ¿no?
She says she's confident the government would have canceled the festival if they thought it was necessary. But just to be safe, she applied antibacterial hand gel every 10 minutes. For The World, Emily Green, Mexico City.
Folks here in the U.S. are getting used to what people in other parts of the world have been doing this winter, staying home in isolation. So as you ease into your new normal, we want to know, what life hack have you discovered that's made your new stay-at-home lifestyle more bearable? Send a voice memo, please, to this email, myworld@theworld.org. Wherever you're listening in the world, help out your fellow quarantine newbies. Tell us your name, your city, and what stroke of creativity and isolation you're proud of. Again, email your voice memo to myworld@theworld.org. Iran has been hit especially hard by the coronavirus. Only China and Italy have more confirmed cases. To try and contain the spread of the disease, Iran has released about 85,000 prisoners, among them British-Iranian national Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe. She's serving 5 years for espionage, a charge she has consistently denied. Her husband, Richard Ratcliffe, joins us on the line from London. Thank you for being with us again, Richard. The last time we spoke, a new concern for Nazanin's health. She was showing symptoms of COVID-19 while in prison in Tehran. How's her health today? What do you know?
Yeah, that's exactly right. She clearly had symptoms, was very ill for about 2 weeks, and then probably after 2 weeks, slowly started getting better. And as of about 4 or 5 days ago, seemed completely clear. So I'm a lot more relieved about her physical health than I was the last time we spoke. She looked great on the phone, and I got to speak to her on Skype. And yeah, I mean, she looked thinner, but a big smile on her face. And of course, it's nothing like being out of prison to feel a lot better.
I can imagine. And she's staying with her parents in Tehran. How did her spirit seem?
Yeah, so that's right. So she's been staying with her parents. She's been given an electronic tag, exceptional. I don't think any other prisoner has been given that. So she's got a radius of 300 meters that she's able to move. So actually, she can't go very far from her parents, can't actually go to the nearest shop or to the park. But yeah, lovely to be out of prison. And I think she spent all morning, apart from speaking to us, calling around family and friends and all those people that aren't able to visit prison, just to sort of catch up and be in contact again with the world outside.
Did she talk about what the separation from her cellmates was like for this temporary release?
Yeah, this morning I spoke to her and she said that she woke up and obviously it was lovely to be at home and to be in her mum's house. But she woke up remembering all her cellmates that had been left behind, who are still suffering and struggling. And her world for the past 4 years has been those cellmates and the friendships they form, how they help each other survive. In fact, when she was leaving yesterday morning, a number of them wore necklaces that she'd made. They all sang songs for her as she was going. That kind of human kindness in a context of real cruelty is so important to keep you going. But yes, it does mean that she really treasures them and hopes that they'll all be okay.
That's really powerful. How concerned are you by the spread and impact of the coronavirus there? And how are your in-laws holding up right now?
Yeah, so I think she's had it. So that obviously changes our worries slightly. And I think she's not contagious now. So my worries about my in-laws are less. Generally, it is a really tough time to be living in Iran at the moment. Coronavirus is in a long list of things that's happened to people in Iran in the past few months. There's a way in which there's almost too much to worry about. And people focus on the here and now and, you know, being grateful that, you know, we've got to a new year and that she's out and we can have some sort of celebration.
Just to clarify, you believe she had COVID-19, but she was not tested?
Yeah, no prisoner has been tested that I'm aware of. I think there's obviously government propaganda put out to say that they have, but I don't think anyone has been tested. Certainly she wasn't. There was certainly a great resistance to testing her. She had all the symptoms. She's got better. Yeah, I'm grateful for that.
And Richard, what was the reaction from your daughter there in London to this news about this release, this temporary release?
Yeah, so I told Gabriella yesterday on the way back from school that, you know, we're going to make a phone call when we get home. And do you know who it was? Do you want to guess? And obviously her first guess wasn't Mummy. And then she was very excited when it was Mummy. And actually, bless her, she asked Nazanin why she'd gone to Granny's house and hadn't come to our house. Mm. So, you know, she's little enough not to be able to process it, but she's big enough to ask some tough questions that can leave her parents stumped.
Richard Ratcliffe, husband of Nazanin Zaghari Ratcliffe, who has been temporarily released from jail in Tehran because of the coronavirus. Richard, thank you very much for your time, and we'll be thinking of you.
Thank you.
As the coronavirus has spread across the world, Africa has watched with concern. There are only about 400 cases on the whole continent. Still, the virus is slowly spreading there. And as Europe begins closing its borders, African nations are taking measures of their own. The world's Halima Gikandi has our story.
This week, Tanzania, Somalia, Liberia, and Benin confirmed their first cases. Dr. Mary Stephen is an officer at the World Health Organization's Africa region in Brazzaville, Congo. She says African countries have been preparing since the beginning of the outbreak in China. Among their top priorities, increasing testing capacity, which has become a big problem in countries like the United States.
Within 1 month, we have moved from 2 reference laboratories in 2 countries to 40 countries that are able to now test and confirm COVID-19.
Scaling up this testing capacity will be crucial for tracking the number of coronavirus cases as they rise. So far, the majority of those cases have been imported not from China, but from Europe and the United States.
Mostly, we saw Europeans coming back for work in Africa and then, of course, importing the disease.
That's why African countries are closing off their borders to Europe, the United States, and other places with high rates of community transmission.
We're imposing a travel ban on foreign nationals from high-risk countries such as Italy, Iran, South Korea, Spain, Germany.
That's President Cyril Ramaphosa of South Africa. He addressed the country over the weekend and announced a state of disaster as the cases of COVID-19 surpassed 60. The president also put restrictions on foreign visas.
We've canceled visas to visitors from those countries from today, and previously granted visas are hereby revoked.
According to South Africa's national news agency, more than 8,000 visas from Europe and China have been canceled. Since the weekend, a flood of other African countries have announced similar travel restrictions. Kenya's president, Uhuru Kenyatta, went one step further, saying he would suspend travel for people coming from any country that has reported coronavirus cases.
Only Kenyan citizens and foreigners with valid residence permits will be allowed to come in.
Dr. Mary Stevens says that while the WHO isn't recommending these types of travel restrictions, countries might be trying to buy themselves time to slow the rates of infection.
Containment will depend on early detection, isolation of the cases, tracking all the contacts, and monitoring them for 14 days.
Many people have warned that COVID-19 could be a disaster in African countries due to their weak health systems. But Dr. Steven notes that the Ebola outbreak helped them lay a solid groundwork to deal with these types of outbreaks. She says there is still a very good chance at containing new coronavirus cases as they emerge.
So not just a chance, a very good chance. A very good chance for containment. We wouldn't say it's out of hand yet.
Dr. Stevens says the goal is to avoid having a scenario like Italy, where local health systems have become completely overwhelmed. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi.
I know the news is worrying to a lot of us, most of us. It's stressful. We're trying to give you a few moments in the show, though, that take the stress away. Here's a song from Belize by the terrific ensemble, the Garifuna Collective. The track is called Ideruni, that translates from the Garinago language as help, and right now, help never sounded so good. New music there from the Garifuna Collective in Belize. The American government has been planning for a catastrophe since the beginning of the Cold War. The coronavirus outbreak is not the same as a nuclear doomsday event, but when it comes to keeping the government functioning, the playbook is pretty similar. Author Garrett Graff wrote about this in his book, Raven Rock. I asked him what kind of plans the U.S. has in place for when the government itself faces an existential threat.
So the government maintains a series of both large and small bunkers and relocation facilities around the country, and particularly outside of Washington. The two major ones being the bunker known as Raven Rock in Waynesboro, Pennsylvania, which is the backup Pentagon, a facility that could support several thousand people effectively indefinitely. And then Mount Weather, a similar sized bunker in Berryville, Virginia, about 80 minutes outside Washington, that would be the primary relocation facility for the president and the executive branch. There was just news at the end of last week that Raven Rock, for instance, has closed itself to any outside visitors to try to ensure the health of the personnel inside the mountain.
How important is the president and the executive branch in these crises? I mean, we're talking about a kind of a system that diffuses power out to people lower down the chain.
Absolutely. And this is one of the things that a lot of people don't really understand, and actually sort of is somewhat comforting in a public health crisis, for instance, where, you know, you might face the president or other people in the senior U.S. government getting ill, which is the president himself is actually not all that important to the functioning of the U.S. government, that these plans and policies are instead geared towards protecting what's known as the office of the presidency, which is everyone in that long line of presidential succession, to ensure that someone is able to remain president, regardless of who that person actually is. This is sort of the weirdness of the president may die, but the presidency always lives.
So who is in charge of making sure those plans are abided by? Because in a crisis, you could imagine the president tweeting, "I'm still in charge."
Yes. And one of the things that would surprise most people about this world is that it's actually entirely run by FEMA. The agency sort of best known for running the country's response to natural disasters actually traces its roots back to being the nation's doomsday nuclear planner. And then in the 1950s and 1960s, it turned out we didn't have all that many nuclear wars. And so the expertise was instead redirected to responding to floods, hurricanes, tornadoes, and other natural disasters.
So if too many people or the head of state gets ill, that's also a clear national security concern.
Yeah, and this is something that we're seeing across many senior governments in the West and around the world. I mean, remember, the UK's health minister has tested positive for coronavirus. You know, the aides around the Brazilian president who was visiting with President Trump at Mar-a-Lago appear to be ill. Justin Trudeau, the Canadian prime minister, his wife has tested positive and he's in self-quarantine. So this is something that governments around the world are wrestling with. And I think what you're seeing is a lot of governments dusting off plans built for wartime that are instead going to be used in this pandemic.
Garrett Graff is a national security writer. His book Raven Rock details how the U.S. government prepares itself for doomsday scenarios. Let's face it, modern life means screen time, and as more people are working from home during the coronavirus outbreak, we are really tethered to our screens and chairs. No more getting up or even just a walk down the hall to a meeting. Thank goodness Derek Evans is here to help.
Hey, guys. How you doing? Time to get that body moving.
You may know him as Mr. Motivator. He rose to fame in the UK in the 90s with his high-energy exercise routines on morning TV and his neon spandex. Here's Mr. Motivator's helpful tips for keeping fit right now.
When you've been sitting around for a long time, even if you're not sitting at home, if you're sitting at the desk and you're using the computer, after a while, you'll find that all those wonderful muscles you have in your body starts to tighten up. You start getting aches in your back of your neck, your shoulders comes up to your ears, your legs get stiff, your back feels stiff. And so what we need to do is we need to encourage ourselves to get up fairly regularly. And I say to everybody, don't walk around barefooted, don't walk around in sandals, but put some trainers or some sneakers, I think you call it in the States. When you have your sneakers on, psychologically, you're already telling yourself, I need to do something.
And if I do it, what should I tell my kid who might be eyeing me suspiciously? How can I get her to join in?
What you do is you say, listen, what's your favorite music? If you start playing music in your home with your trainers on, straight away it starts becoming something that you start thinking about. And the next thing is your posture is the key thing. So let's think about an exercise that we can all do and the kids can do. Imagine that there's an orange between your shoulder blades or a lemon in between your shoulder blades. And I want you to gently squeeze the juice out of that lemon or orange and let the juice run down your back. Automatically, you've changed your posture.
Any other tips to keep the spirits up? Like, should we set a timer to remind us to move?
I think everybody should use their phone, use their Fitbit, use their alarm clock, and set that for every 30 minutes or every 45 minutes to get yourself to get up and start moving.
Lead us through like a 30-second little workout. Pick us a song. We'll find it. And lead me through 30 seconds.
Okay. A good song to use is always something like, let's think, McFadden or Whitehead. Ain't No Stopping Us Now.
Love it.
All right. So here we go. You're pushing your shoulders up to your ears once and two and three and four. Then the next thing you're going to do, you're going to get up. So the hands are on the thighs. You're going to push and stand up. Two, three, four, going down slowly. Two, three, four. So you're sitting back down in the chair. Then whilst you're sitting in the chair, we're going to march. Lift your legs up one at a time. You march and you move your arms in tune to the music. So you're going one, two, three, say yeah. Go one, two, three,
ain't
say
no
yeah.
Come on. Now we're on the move.
We've got everybody moving. But if you make it fun, people are more likely to do it. And the interesting thing is you've got so much in your home that you can use for exercise. You've got the stairs. You can go up and down the stairs.
When you're practicing social distancing at home, are you still wearing that amazing neon spandex, or are you in your pajamas like the rest of us?
You know what? At the moment, I'm actually sitting here in Leica. Listen, you dress how you want to dress. But as I said before, if you put your sneakers on, you're more likely to start moving. If you want to wear a baggy trousers and a baggy T-shirt, that's okay. What you need to do is just be comfortable. Set your alarm clock. Get up as often as you can. Do a few press-ups. I do my press-up in terms of the amount of years I've been on this earth. So I've been on this earth for 67 years. Wow. I do 67 press-ups all in one go.
Man.
I wasn't able to do it initially, but I've grown to and taught myself to do it, and now it's really easy.
Well, for you today, Derek, Mr. Motivator Evans, Lycra is the right answer. Thank you. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
From the world's Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be right back here with you tomorrow. Ain't no stopping us now.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.